and gentlemen, welcome to the French Connections Monday edition. Today's date is the 11th of February, 2008, and my name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It's great to have you here for another installment of the French Connection. Of course, we've been following very closely as possible, this financial mess, because this is the one that is really going to show itself to be the devastating event in our recent past here. And I think what we've got coming is becoming clearer, albeit difficult to pinpoint the dates and times for the problems that we're going to face. It is becoming easier to find out the extent of the problem. What I've been reading is that the next problem to really surface is how deep and how involved Japanese banks were in buying these packaged loans from the American market, and also in the first quarter. And I said this back in November and December, when the quarterly reports are required to come out, we would start seeing clear indications that the problems were international and how deep they actually were. Because, ladies and gentlemen, banks cannot hide these problems if they're honest with their shareholders. Now, privately held companies can hide them and they can shuffle things around, but publicly held companies in an honest environment are required to show what they've done to these things. So, that being said, I'm going to bring up my guest who's been with me several times on this subject alone, but many times on others. His name is Mohammed Rafiq, and he is calling from London, outside of London, and we are going to start right away. Mohammed, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Donald. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I've been watching the growth of this problem as you have. I did make a couple of predictions that we would see serious events by the end of February. We would have, you know, this was back in December. I said this early December, that by February we would start seeing companies having serious problems. We're seeing all those things, aren't we?
We are indeed. I mean, one of the things is that they've been trying to keep a lid on how serious the whole situation is, how far the problems go, and what the true causes of the problems are. They've really tried hard to suppress that. We also said quite some time ago that among the groups that they were trying to blame for the cause were the subprime borrowers, completely ignoring, of course, the fact that somebody had lent to them. As I've stated from the outset, it's not merely a subprime issue. It goes back to the fundamental methodology which has been rolled out around the G10 countries and all the other countries which subscribe to the new capital accord, the new way that banks manage their capital. That, Daryl, of course, is the new version of the so-called fractional reserve system, whereby the reserves just pale into negligence and the amount of capital which can be borrowed and lent goes out massively based on the offsetting principle. So what we have is something which has got nothing to do with subprime. There have been some weak statements in the press, such as the Bank for International Settlements, who authored these new rules, saying people have relied too much on the models and nonsense like this, when the whole new regulatory framework is a model-based framework. So you can't say people are relying too much on the models. The models are the new methodology by which fractional reserve is implemented.
Well, here's the interesting thing that we discussed yesterday privately, there is a cascading effect, and there are levels of this debt that are going bust. And of course, people, you cannot blame an unworthy credit person. Somebody goes into a bank, they've got maybe some bad loans in the past and some bad credit history and blah blah blah, and you can't blame them for putting their name on an application and trying to get money. The people who are supposed to be guarding the chicken coop were the banks themselves, and instead they put a blind eye to these poor credit risks and they lent the money in large numbers. I mean, we're talking about they fudged the numbers on tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of home loans and car loans and credit card issuances. It was almost willful in the way they did it, but that's not the real problem. The real problem is, as the richer people above this group started seeing the poorer people below start showing signs of wealth, and they decided to go back to the bank and put their houses up for a second mortgage and draw off the equity in that home. And what they did was they set up a different level of problem called the prime risk problem. What we've got, people with very good credit ratings going into this crisis are now coming out of it with horrible problems because the equity in their home is less valuable than the money they borrowed. And there is a whole nother group now that's starting to go bankrupt, aren't there?
Well, of course, Dale, they're not just starting to go bankrupt. I mean, from the day that they signed their forms and overstretched themselves. And in reality, somebody who goes back and overstretches themselves, because it was the two-edged sword, as usual, Dale. We had runaway house prices in the United States, which, you know, suddenly people realized, hey, we've got all this equity sat there, and we can get these special types of introductory remortgages, not just new mortgages, but remortgages. We can get the cash and buy that boat I've always wanted or the car that I've always wanted for cash and get it at really cheap rates. So, you know, it became a very big temptation for the middle classes. And the failure, which was of most note in the last week, has been a AAA-rated credit union in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
By virtue of that credit union having a AAA rating, it means it was only ever lending to prime borrowers. You know, these were the safest bet to lend. And we've seen them go from AAA to AA. So nobody can say this has got anything to do with subprime any longer.
Well, let's take a look at another historical event that has many parallels to today's crisis, but in a smaller venue. The Japanese economy back in the 80s, of course, was exploding. There was all kinds of capital being released out of the Central Bank of Japan. And they started themselves into a real estate buying binge as well. And by the late 1980s, early 1990s, they had an enormous real estate bubble. You could pick up an apartment in Tokyo that was 25 feet square and sell it for $1 million, and people were just out there playing playing a roulette wheel with apartments. What we do know is by the early 90s, 91, 92, 93, that bubble blew. And it sent Japan into a tailspin that they have yet to pull out of. And my point being is that I'm wondering, and this is just out loud, was that a setup? Were they practicing what to do to the rest of the world? I mean, everybody saw that this speculating in housing was going to end badly. So why did a decade later the Americans do the exact same thing, but then pass on the debt of this mess to the world? It seems to me that somebody was using that smaller market as a test case. Maybe. What do you think, Mohammed?
Well, we can certainly say that anybody who studied finance to any degree could look at what happened there and say there is a classic housing bubble, and that's the model, that's what it looks like, and here's what happens afterwards. And that in itself should cause sensible, responsible people to want access to credit regulated and access to housing regulated, so that a home remains a home and doesn't become, because this is where the twist begins, this is where the distortion occurs, when we're told that a house is no longer a home but an investment.
Yep.
From that point onwards, it ceases to be a home, and it is then something which is traded.
Yep.
You know, and this—it's the whole psychology. And as usual, the average man in the street is not very well educated. They are actually much better educated in America than other parts of the world in respect of finance. You know, a lot of guys and women out in the States will trade their own positions, especially manage their own pensions and things like that. That's quite rare in the world. So the Americans generally are better informed, certainly the middle classes. And these prime mortgages, which went flat, went from AAA to AA last week. The cost of borrowing there, of course, for the whole credit union has just increased by 40 basis points.
And for people who don't know what that means, when you are borrowing, you're getting money over a prime rate, and it, sometimes it's 10 basis points over prime or 20 basis points over prime. This is what you can go into your open window to fill your bank's coffers to lend. And when you get it up to 40 basis points over the prime rate, that is completely devastating to the bottom line, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is. And within the credit rating models, there's some fairly fixed points. The prime rate is generally in the U.S. seen as the Federal Reserve rate.
Right.
What would happen there is that a AAA-rated institution will borrow at 10 basis points above that,
right.
AA at 40, and so on. And this is why, as you come down the credit scale, the cost of borrowing increases and increases and increases. So their cost of borrowing has just increased at the wholesale markets, because they as a AAA now, as a AA now, can't go to primary markets for that. They have to go to the secondary markets. So they're borrowing off AAAs now, as opposed to from the prime borrowing. So it's more expensive for them. So the implication of this, of course, Darrell, is that at a time when they're running into financial difficulties and the problems are starting to open up in the credit union, if that weren't bad enough, the cost of borrowing just increased.
Right.
You know, it's this kind of strange punishment that happens to companies when they're not doing well, is that they get punished even more. And when we look at who they're borrowing, who were borrowing from this credit union, I saw a very interesting example, Darrell. One guy in the States, I think he was, I forget exactly which, he was either a dentist or a vet, veterinarian surgeon, one of these two, sort of professional, middle-class type. And he'd gone and mortgaged himself to the max. As I understand it, he'd released the equity to expand his practice, whatever field he was in, he wanted to expand it. Mm-hmm. So he used the money to try and grow his business. But that actually failed, and he was not successful in that. In the meantime, he had this large ARM, as you called them, as you pointed out, now ARM in the States, adjustable rate mortgage to pay. And the way that it works, as I now understand it, is that he had a monthly payment of, say, $1,200 on his mortgage.
Yep.
But he could only afford $600 every month. But that wasn't a problem, because for 3 years, if he paid less than the amount he owed, the difference between what he paid and what his monthly payment should have been was added to the outstanding balance of capital. So for 3 years, Darrell, he's able to underpay his mortgage by half, and sometimes he admitted less than half. At the end of that 3 years, all those mispayments have been added on, plus there's been interest added on to them, plus the interest that he hasn't paid. So all of a sudden, they're turning around to him after 3 years of being in this ARM mortgage and saying, okay, Mr. Dentist, you now have to give us the full monthly payment, which is now $1,280 or $1,300, whatever the new amount is. At which point he says, I can't afford this, and gives the keys back to them and walks away.
Yep. And isn't that interesting? Because I mentioned to you yesterday that's the big trend now, especially in some of the western cities that have been hit hardest, Las Vegas, San Diego, San Francisco even, outskirts of San Francisco, where people are just deciding one day, they do the math, they take the keys and put them in a manila envelope, and they address it to the mortgage lender, and they mail their keys in, and they get in their car and drive away. And some of them are even leaving their furnishings behind because all of the furnishings are owed on, too. They got loans on those. And the problem here, though, see, one of the things that people are not really wrapping their brain around is that as this thing deepens, there is a knock-on effect across the economy that has a it feeds on itself. There is a negative spiral beginning to develop here, where because you live in a city that has manufacturing of white goods or you do a lot of shipping. Let's say you're in Long Beach, California. You ship everything in from China and you work at the docks. Well, all of a sudden nobody can buy anything, so your shipping has been cut by 30%. So all of a sudden you get laid off. Well, the local store that used to rely on your buying now doesn't have your money coming in, and they need to lay some people off, which in turn causes even deepening of the problem because that person now has to pull his purse strings in tightly. And what you see here is a vicious cycle of downward movement here. And unless something comes in to stop that downward spiral, the entire system can fail. Now, you know as well as I do, when an economy relies on 70% of its growth in GDP on the individual spending, and then that individual can no longer spend, that economy is toast. What do you think?
Absolutely, Carolyn. You know, those mortgages that you're talking about there, these ARM mortgages where people are walking out and even leaving the furniture behind, the mortgage broker that I was reading who was discussing this situation with these prime borrowers in the United States said that they're now calling these ARM mortgages neutron mortgages because they say what happens is that, you know, at the end of the ARM period, the buildings are left standing, but there's no people in them in the city that are neutron workers.
That's out of control, that. But see, it is absolutely true. And what they're starting to see is entire neighborhoods. Now, here's a statistic that just came out yesterday on the Newswire. 19 out of 21 major home markets in the United States experienced a major contraction in sales and pricing last quarter. Now, there were a couple of exceptions. One of them was Denver. I don't know why that is. But and that's only slated to get worse, Muhammad. Now, here's the problem everybody faces, and so for people out there who are already in this, I'm not telling you something you don't already know. But for those of you who are not aware, once your house has dropped in value below the value of your original down payment, and your monthly payment becomes a negative cash flow event, the only reason you're staying in that house is because you want a roof over your head. But as you see things deepening and problems becoming more serious as far as you being able to pay, you are in a situation where you're throwing your good money after bad. And so people are starting to walk away even though they could probably pay the mortgage. This is what's starting to happen. There are people walking away, Muhammad, who have the capacity to pay their mortgage, but they're refusing to because the house they're paying on is no longer worth as much as they owe.
That's right. I mean, this is another factor which is occurring in the neutron prime borrower market, is that what they're seeing happen, the drop in market prices of properties, and they're saying, whoa, we were led to believe that this was a growth curve that wasn't going to fall back on us, and we really overstretched ourselves and borrowed massively to pay for this place. It's not worth as much now as the amount we've even borrowed. We're not going to pay that amount anymore, and they're just walking. Of course, in the UK, you can't walk in the negative equity scenario. What happens here, and we can be fairly sure that it's about to start happening here, all the signs are that it's going into reverse here. It's stopped growing, and there are some downward trends here in the UK now as well, Darrell. What happens here is that when you can't keep up the payments and you send back the keys, the mortgage company is allowed to sell that property on the market. And even if you paid £300,000 for it, and they sell it for £30,000, they don't care. For the simple reason that English law allows them to continue to pursue you for the difference. So that £300,000 that you borrowed, and they get £30,000 back. And this happened when the property prices collapsed in the UK in the early 90s, Darryl. People had their homes repossessed, sold at auction with no reserve for peanuts. Properties were going for one-third and less of the mortgage amount. But the person who borrowed the money was still legally liable for the debt, and they were actually forced to continue making payments for a mortgage on a property that they no longer had. And some people were 8 or 10 years, Darryl, getting out of that hole before they'd actually managed to pay off the difference.
Well, and you know as well as I do that the way this is shaping up, and of course this cascading situation that I just described earlier, I don't see anything short of a miracle stopping it. Now, they're able to keep this major stuff from hitting the press because they control the press. The people in charge of things are not allowing the general public to know just how serious this is. And people with a knowledge in finance are pretty clear about how bad this is. And I'm wondering, Mohammed, how long do you believe that they can keep papering over or you know, disguising the depth of this problem? I mean, I can't see it going on much longer. It's again, I said by the end of February, everybody and their brother would be aware we're in a crap storm and nobody has an umbrella.
Well, the fact that a AAA credit union, which means that everybody understands that from virtue of them being AAA, that they've only lent to prime borrowers, for them to be downgraded means that they have problems. That means prime borrowers have problems. They've been, because it's, as I understand it, a quasi-public institution, a credit union.
That's right.
They can't actually hide their reports and accounts like the banks are doing. So lots of other people, lots of other institutions rather, who've lost really, really heavily under these circumstances, are actually hiding the fact in their reports and accounts by using, you know, profits from previous years and pulling them forward, borrowing, doing whatever they can to massage the figures so that George and his mates look like they and Bernanke don't look like they've made a tremendous mistake or series of mistakes which have plunged millions of people into difficult scenarios. Coming back to your point, Darryl, of the housing market collapse bleeding over into other areas, a very important first sign that we discussed privately yesterday that we should cover here is the collapse in the motor industry, which is occurring at the moment.
Yep, yep.
This is the first luxury good, and this is a big warning to everybody there. The first luxury good when recession, because some economists are now using the word that we've been using for the last 3 months, Darryl, recession. Some economists are talking about the fact that we're in recession, and the issue now is, you know, how long, how deep, those kinds of questions. But the first thing that goes in a recession are luxury items.
Yeah.
And the first luxury item which goes is the car, where people might change a car every 2 years or 3 years. That's going to become 5 years or 7 years, and they'll just have to make do rather than changing it.
Well, you read to me right out of your local newspaper some of the price cuts that have been going on. We're talking 3,000-4,000 pounds of reduction on a regular car. Now you're talking. Now, ladies and gentlemen, of course, £1 is $2. So, let's say a 3,000-pound reduction. That's $6,000 off the list price. We've got cars being sold for £9,000 that were listed at 15.
That's correct. Now we've got 15,000-pound vehicles now being offered in the local papers at 9,995, just under £5 short of 10,000, and some of them on interest-free finance over 5 years.
Yeah.
I mean, these people are desperate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's happening here in France as well. There is no Western economy immune to this. And I think, by and large, it's because of what we described in previous files that this was an exported problem out of the United States that got it started. But it's really not the prime, subprime problem, but basically a derivatives market gone crazy with the value that was placed on these as a notion rather than as a real value has now become real. When one of these problems hits one of these instruments, these derivatives, it becomes a real debt instead of just a piece of an equation. But, see, they were selling these forward as equations, as a mathematical formula, and really it didn't seem to them that because it was zeroed out with a zero sum, you know, where you had an offsetting asset, that this would ever go belly up. So to them, it was just a piece of paper that had a mathematical formula applied. Well, now that mathematical formula is actually real, and someone needs to get paid. And the payment on this entire nightmare is in the tens and hundreds of trillions of dollars. Now, just to keep things propped up, Mohammed, I've seen already at least a couple of trillion pumped into the system, either through printing money or through actual bailouts. Now, talk to people about the recent bailout of Northern Rock. It's not $25 billion like they said. I read somewhere they've got $95 billion belly up on that thing.
Well, as I said originally, Dal, and we were the first to broadcast this fact, and we discussed this last December, and I pointed out to people that the $25 billion which had been put in was just to balance the capital of the company, because its capital was now the old fractional reserve system. To think of, for people to understand that, that it was at say 20-1, but they actually didn't have one; it had gone to 2,000-1. So the money was put in the first instance to balance capital, and secondly to pay off some big international banks, so as to maintain confidence in the City of London that, hey, don't worry, Northern Rock's gone bad, but these foreign companies, which from whichever country it was they were trying to look after, keep them sweet, keep the fear away from them, whatever their motive was, it was in that sort of thinking that money went straight to them. Now we're looking at all the other people that need paying out, the UK borrowers and also the depositors, plus the UKs and maybe safe European counterparties, or maybe Deutsche Banks of this world and the BNP Paribas, these kind of the big institutions that they now owe money to, and they're being told you have to pay. So the first tranche of money was for capital and some high priority debts. This amount of money is far more in line with the amount of money that Barclays was borrowing, that UBS have borrowed from sovereign governments. This, we're now beginning to realize, hey, this meltdown is just so vast and so unstoppable. And the thing is, Daryl, that with the public companies like Barclays, like UBS, like Northern Rock, they can't hide it.
That's right.
It's intriguing that the Zionist financial institutions such as NM Rothschild are still actually privately owned. It's even in its holding state a sole trading entity, not even a limited liability company. So nothing even gets filed at company's house, the smallest possible register that we would have in the UK for a company that's worth, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars and has exposure into the trillions of dollars. And they don't actually have to report anything anywhere, and they don't.
Well, now as this thing gets deeper, I, like I said, this always, the governments don't want to be caught with their public paying attention to their wallets. They want people to rally around the flag, if you will. And it seems to me that this is a perfect time for them to pull their next nightmare. Now, of course, I think the fact that we've worked so hard here at the French Connection, and many other people have worked very hard to try and get the world aware of what we're facing, they can't just you know, pull a rabbit out of their hat. They have to do a real good job of convincing the general public that whatever war they want to start or whatever crisis they want to get rolling is real. And that's going to be a tough sell because if you take a look at the American numbers, at least, half of the public now does not believe 9/11 was what the government said. Now, many of them, those 50%, don't know what happened, but they certainly know whatever they were told was crap. Now, that means that you've got a whole lot of skepticism in the country, and it's going to be a heck of a lot more difficult this time to sell another false flag terror attack and then make actions based upon that. So they're kind of in a tough spot as well. But isn't it in their MO to start looking for ways of covering their financial nightmare with some sort of war action or some sort of terrorist action?
Ordinarily, they would move into false flag operations. That's their MO. That's what they've done throughout the centuries. The problem now, Darryl, as you pointed out, is that there are probably 100 million people plus worldwide waiting for another event, all sat there with the most sophisticated computing equipment, all ready to dissect whatever happens into billions of pieces from lots of different angles, and the stuff will come out even faster than it did on 9/11 because people have learned to use the tools, learned what questions to ask, and are so healthily skeptical. You know, if you could just go back 5 years ago, Darryl, it was a lot harder trying to get that message across. It was very fringe, very, you're an extremist, you're on the lunatic fringe, you're not mainstream, you're not, you know, it was all that, go away, I don't want to hear it. Now, like you say, 50% of the United States, and like 70% of Europe, all are of the view that 9/11 was orchestrated by government forces, whichever government it was. So we have a very different paradigm, very difficult for them to do something. And also, Darryl, they were the people who pushed for the new regulatory framework. There'd been a battle, you know, Darryl, going on for a long time between people who, you know, didn't mind fractional reserve banking but didn't want it to get ridiculous. So they tried to outlaw concepts like the bank multiplier effect and try to limit the exposure that the banks were able to get. And you've had this lot who pushed it from 1/8 of 1% 200 years ago to practically infinity today, the same group pushing and pushing, probably most likely motivated by greed. And when the opportunity came for unlimited borrowing and unlimited exposure, they were the first to go out and start packaging up subprime. They were, the old saying, pressure to lend, you know, when the multiplier was, when it was set at, say, 10 to 1 and a bank was at 7 to 1, they were under pressure to lend to people so that they were a maximum capital ratio, 10 to 1. In this instance, it was just, hey, lend to anybody anything. Just lend anything because we can. When there's no limits, we don't have to pick and choose who we lend to. We can just keep lending and lending. As long as we bring properties back to say that the debt has got an asset underlying it, we can lend again. We get 100% relief on this. So they didn't care. From a bank capital perspective, there was no limit. It was limitless borrowing, lending rather. Absolutely.
Well, now, but see, Mohammed, here's where it really gets... They're also pushing a political agenda toward this supremacist Middle Eastern doctrine where Israel is taking advantage of the fact that the world is distracted at the moment with their own personal and national problems of finances and problems with spending power in their own home currencies, and they're taking advantage of it by destroying, committing a genocide against the Palestinian people, first off, but they're also starting to look at ways of coveting the rest of the water that they were, the Litani River. They want to go back into the Bekaa Valley and start grabbing that water. They've already, Sheba Farms has now become part of Israel, much like the Golan Heights did. They've got the aquifer over there already being pumped out dry. They're already having designs on the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates River. They've already, shown that they are, that the Egyptian government is a lapdog to their policies. All of this stuff is happening almost under the radar because of all the other problems in the news. And I'm saying to you right now that they're going to turn up, notch up, ratchet up the mess. Because one of the things that happens to me even is I get information overload. I mean, you can't follow this stuff, Muhammad. It's a massive amount of information constantly bombing your brain. And they depend on that.
Indeed, they one of the things that they also like to do is not just to overload, but to, in terms of quantity, but also overload in terms of volume. And that actually goes back to Moses Ginsberg, who was one of the founders of, if you like, the spiritual Zionism, back in the late 19th century. He said one thing that we have to use is noise. We have to use lots of noise, and we have to complain and complain loudly. And when we do things loudly. And they try to use the method of attrition. The thing is now that the number of people out there who are watching what they're doing is actually beginning to wear them down. It's an irony, you know, Darryl, that the financial markets have collapsed before they managed to collapse the economic systems of the world. And they're in a very difficult dilemma because as a force in banking, they were the group that pushed the hardest. The people, for instance, who founded GARP, the Global Association of Risk Professionals, I knew people who were there. One of their names were quite famous. One of them was Lev Borodovsky, obviously Levi. The three main guys who founded that were all Jews, Zionists to boot, and they are the ones who went out in the mid-90s trying to encourage people to adopt this new market risk framework. It was all done on the basis of greed, and that these people...
But was it only greed, or was it this? Is this implosion some sort of grand design? I mean, I think they want this world to fall into chaos.
Well, they do, but the thing is that they didn't think this was going to be the mechanism by which it happened, Darryl. It's a very good question, because yes, they do want that to happen, but this was never the mechanism. And the reason we know it's not the mechanism is that they actually put themselves and their companies right in the thick of all of this and took on some of the biggest exposures. We're only seeing the public exposures, but the private exposures are much greater. And when we know that ING, Baring, the largest Dutch bank,
yep,
turned around to N.M. Rothschild, who were in the process of buying them out, N.M. Rothschild had to back down suddenly whilst all of this meltdown's been going on. They've melted down, they've backed away because they don't have the money to go through with the purchase. And ING have actually asked the Royal Bank of Scotland if they'll do it instead. So we know for a fact that although Rothschilds and Co. don't actually publish any of their information, we know they've been hit that badly that they can no longer afford to buy out ING Barings.
Well, I that's a speculation that I don't see. Now, my early research told me that the Rothschild fortunes had their fingers in pies that amounted to over a couple of $100 trillion worldwide. Now, if that's true, that's the worldwide GDP times 10 in a year.
Well, they obviously have got a large number of assets that they've built up over time and a lot of cash. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it was those kinds of numbers, but they're fairly big numbers. The thing is that, you know, we know, for instance, that when the Rothschild family tried to leave France rather than fight the Germans in 1941 and fight to save the Jewish community, they were the first ones on the boats to the States. And as I explained in a previous show, they tried to leave it. I think the sum was £63 million pounds, the equivalent thereof, which would have, of course, been French francs, which were, I think, were In the Second World War, I think there was still about 8 to 1, 10 to 1, somewhere around there. And the wartime government taxed them just before the panzer tanks rolled in over France, actually. They were leaving immediately before, so they obviously knew they were coming. But the Pétain government would not let him take more than £1 million equivalent. And so they were forced to leave the rest behind, which was confiscated by way of what was known as an exodus tax. So,
well,
actually,
I'm looking right now as I said that's in the opening of the program, that what I understand the next shoe to drop here is the Japanese exposure. And everyone is starting to realize that Japan was actually a spigot, a faucet, with unlimited money to go out and flood the markets with. They were using this carry trade and all this other stuff going on with their zero interest rates. Basically, that place is going to get hammered by their exposure, and they've got, I think, three or four of the top 10 banks in the world are Japanese. Now, if their exposure is anywhere near what the rest of the Western world has been, we're in for a much larger, we're exponentially growing this crisis. And I'm seeing that the Middle East now is actually starting to contract. And you're getting a lot of balking at the old guard, especially out of the oil-rich areas of Saudi Arabia and whatnot. And it looks like we're ready for a conflagration here. I see bad things coming, because when trapped rats get cornered, Muhammad, they strike out at you. And these people, you know, they want mayhem. I don't want to make any predictions here, but it just seems to me that this is an opportunity for them to pull the plug here. And I'm wondering if you see any actions that would be indicative of that kind of event.
I think they want to go with it simply because they can't repair the financial system. The problem with the inability to repair it is that I believe a lot of them have got very large exposures themselves, and therefore they can't afford to allow that position to realize. They're between a rock and a hard place, because if they let it collapse, maybe one or two of their own financial institutions will actually collapse, and their reputations will go with it. And that's the thing to remember here, Daniel. They might be able to let go of a bank here or a bank there, but if it's Loyomi Bank, or, you know, we know this is an Israeli bank or a Jewish-owned bank, and they go all pear-shaped and go bust, then that's very bad for the reputations of the people involved. So they're very, and they, you know, they're aware that in banking, reputation is king. So it's very important to them to keep the reputation at any price. So I think that you've got one group who's saying, hey, let's push the accelerator, let's do the pedal to the metal, because, you know, we've got nothing to lose. And there's a small group within that faction who's saying, well, you might not have anything to lose, but we've got massive exposures here, and we need to do something to change this position around before you press that accelerator. And you can see this going on out there. It looks like it's accelerating, then all of a sudden some group are applying pressure, using the contacts they've got to stop it from going any further. There's clearly amongst themselves division and infighting, clearly.
Well, now I spoke to you yesterday for the first time in a couple of weeks, actually, and you were, taking care of business of your own and whatnot. And I've been looking at the general public where I live. Now, you have to understand, I don't live in a very sophisticated area. People here are real salt of the earth. I mean, you know, they're wearing the old fashioned caps on their heads, the old berets and stuff. And this is an old fashioned area. But even here, Muhammad, people are very aware of what is happening, and they are actually beginning to become very fearful. And France has registered some of the worst numbers economically for faith in the economy ever recorded. They've been doing polling on people's confidence in the economy since the early 1970s, And this reading was by a long margin the worst reading ever taken, which means to me is that there everyone's going to pull their wallet tighter, as I talked about earlier, and we have a vicious cycle of implosion coming. And I'm wondering how individuals in our listening audience can read the tea leaves in their own environments and start taking all the advantages they have available to them, and they're not going to be many, but any available to them. See, I've told people that they need to start looking more basically at their world, you know, because the services that you rely on to have a daily life may not be available in the short or near term. I mean, if money becomes as scarce as I believe it will, ultimately, your local grocery store won't be in business anymore. Your local car company that you get your car fixed won't be there. There'll be nothing that you're familiar with around you. And you, what do you think people need to start thinking about here? It's a tough question.
Well, it is a difficult question, Darryl. Among the things to look at here, one is, you know, the extent of lying. People have got to wise up to this, because we've been warning for this for 3 months. The extent of lying and dishonesty by so-called professionals in the financial markets who are going along with the cover-up of how bad things are. You know, 3 months after the fact, they're coming out and telling people what we were telling people, you know, that this isn't about subprime and this is far worse and it's all to do with capital and the nature of the mathematics is such that it's an irredeemable situation. Eventually someone's going to come out and admit that side of it. Then what we've added to that, which is they messed up, to put it mildly, on the Christmas opportunity, the effect that that's going to have on the different market sectors, not to mention the fallout from the mortgage and property market is now bleeding over into the luxury goods markets. So all of this is going on, and in the meantime, these people who ordinarily we rely on to say there's a problem here and this is wrong with the economy, and that's, they're ignoring it. They're not coming out and saying anything. And that is extremely dangerous, because that's not warning people to start looking at taking action, whether it's limiting the amount of borrowing they're doing, paying off debts that they can get rid of, looking at maybe taking on I don't know what you'd call this in America, and in the UK, an allotment where you grow a bit of your own food and things like that,
yep.
just to protect yourself against inflationary pricing. Another thing, which I mentioned to you yesterday, Darryl, we should discuss this because it's quite important. There is a concept that's in humanity which predates money called barter.
Yep.
And there is a group called BarterCard who have got a system whereby, you know, you become a BarterCard member and you say, if I was a hairdresser, for instance, I would charge people so many barter pounds for cutting their hair, and the barter bank would give me a check from their own account. I would pay that into my barter bank account, and I could use that for anybody else in the barter system to, you know, buy food, or, you know, get my shoes repaired or some clothing. There are people who come together and use it as an alternative currency, an alternative medium of exchange. But something which shocked me, Darryl, that I didn't know until yesterday, and you told me, BarterCard, which is the most famous implementation of this around the world, it is now international BarterCard. You can actually get barter pounds, whatever they call them, I forget the name of their currency, in America, and spend them in the UK. It is genuinely international, but it's illegal in France, I believe, Darryl.
Yes, it's illegal because it circumvents the tax code and tax structure, so there is none. Now, that doesn't stop the local community from trying to do bartering on their own, but the government structure here is that you get government representatives showing up at your house grilling you over what did you do with the hay from your back field. Did you sell it to the farmer next door, or did you leave it in the field, or did you... Well, who cut your grass, they ask you. And if you say, well, this guy down the street cut my grass, and they say, well, did you pay him cash? And you say, well, why do you care if I paid him cash? Well, did he declare the cash as income? And you know, it's a can of worms, and they are coming at your home with a microscope and a fine-tooth comb, and they dig through your stuff. And I got to tell you something, there is virtually no way anybody around here can escape with bartering, because anytime you barter, it has a tax liability in France. You can't barter without that. And listen, you can't go here. This is how bad it is here. And I know that this is the model for other places later. They export these crazy ideas out of this place to others. If you have a flea market and you go and sell household goods from your house at a flea market, they're expecting some sort of payment, the government is.
Wow.
Yeah. They check you. You have to pay a fee to start selling it, and they're looking in the local area for ways of taxing the transactions.
The whole point is that what we can see there is that the forces that be are actually very genuinely frightened of the concept of barter.
Yeah.
Why? Because barter frees us from money. The money which they're controlling, the levels of supply, and that they demand that we go to the banks and use. As soon as we go into barter, and sophisticated barter like the barter card mechanism, we're in a situation where they're not in control of our lives. And they can't enforce taxation, and people start waking up to, hey, why are we paying tax? Hey, why is the government collecting all of this stuff? What is this all about? People start to ask questions that they don't want them asking, because the answers don't sit very comfortably. We very soon start thinking, well, if we can just do this, who's creating this money? Why do we have to keep borrowing it? You know, you create barter pounds simply by virtue of cutting somebody's hair. You monetize production and you monetize business activity. That's the way that the money actually comes into being, you see. So,
in other words, what you just said is that you create money out of a service or a good. And rather than creating it out of thin air, you're actually giving something of value in exchange for the credit that's going to be placed on your account. So that's not created from thin air, it's created from the sweat of someone's brow.
Exactly. And that's radically different. And it also, you know, what it does is it allows us to put into circulation representation of that person's sweat, that effort, that the work that they've been putting in. And obviously different people, it's a very equitable system, because different people obviously can put their different hourly rates in there. And it's not long, Daryl, before you find out, you know, how many loaves of bread it is for you to be able to get the wood that you need to burn for an entire winter. So
that's right.
You can be busy away baking, knowing that as long as I produce this many loaves of bread, you know, I've got the heating for the winter sorted out. You can plan a lot more easily using these things. And barter, when money becomes of no value, the thing that people always revert to is barter. And going and studying barter card right now, even if you live in a place where it's not legal, is well worth doing, because the people involved in those communities, and there's more than just barter card, there's many different barter schemes. I believe in the UK, Daryl, we have more than 100.
Mm-hmm.
The people involved in those schemes, will their activities in those schemes will remain completely and utterly unaffected by any change in the value of money.
That's right, because it's basically a supply and demand of your particular service, and how many credits you can garner through providing that service at any given price related to demand. Now, here's one of the things I wanted to bring up. The barter card is a great thing for people to look into, and if anybody out there in the listening audience wants to send me information about that, I'd like to look over it and maybe help people to start examining the possibility of either starting a barter system or finding out ways of participating in it yourself. The Ron Paul debacle that I and you, we were talking back in October about Ron Paul, you and I, that this guy sounded like a shill to me, and by virtue of his associations with my first red flag with this guy was Alex Jones, knowing full well that Alex Jones was a Zionist denier and that he was pushing Ron Paul like a mad dog, that I knew right away something was wrong with the guy. But then I subsequently discovered that he was a co-author of a book with a guy from the PNAC. The chairman of the PNAC committee was a co-author with him on a book about gold, and gold should be replacing our monetary system. My point being is that this guy has now folded his hand in the political realm, come out and said that he does not believe 9/11 theory about the implosions are real. He thinks everybody's a crackpot for thinking that way. Said that in one of his interviews. And on top of that, $20 million has been given to this guy, which God only knows where that money went to. And if that money had been given to someone like myself, we might already be finished with these criminals. You give me $20 million and let me start squawking like crazy out there in the mainstream, we would have had the whole world awakened with $20 million. But the fact is, this guy has folded, he's walked away, and his last quote to his supporters was a quote from Trotsky, one of the most vicious and vile human beings of the last century, a rabid nutjob Zionist who is responsible for the setup of millions of deaths and enslavement of entire populations, and he uses Trotsky as his model when he's speaking. Now, of course, he was in the Mises Institute, another Zionist-run camp, and we pointed this out from the beginning, Muhammad, from the day one. Now, I did not get a single email that said you were right from the beginning, Darryl, about Ron Paul. Not one person emailed me saying that. But I was absolutely right about this guy from the first day. Now, why is it people are so on? There's so much noise out there and so much distraction that people don't end up wrapping their brain around the facts that we put out. But we've been right on so many things here; it's unbelievable.
We've been on the money on just about everything, and I mean, your suspicions about Ron Paul from your research about him were perfectly justified. My argument was always that it's not going to be possible, and what people really have to live up to take on board and accept, and it's a very painful thing we're asking them to do, you know, especially with all this overload, but something they have to do is resign to the fact that it's not possible for somebody to come out of the existing electoral systems, get into the top and change everything for good. That's just not going to happen. It can't feasibly happen. The nature of the process by which they get there means that they're so compromised by the time they get into the top position that they don't have any room left to make decisions anyway.
That's right.
The amount of money they take on board from all these different political corporate groups and people with all their agendas, by the time they actually get to the top of the political pile in the United States and here in the UK, they're completely sold out. So the actual framework that says these people are allowed to accept money from corporations, we're so brainwashed. People are so brainwashed that we can stand by and watch a political process where these people are being voted for by the people to represent the people, yeah? That's the whole point. And they're taking money left, right, and center so that when they get to that position, they will swing legislation. In reality, these are open bribes, Darryl. That's a bribe. It's an open bribe. And we call it a political donation, and all of a sudden it's not a criminal offense.
Well, but see, he went beyond that. The guy was from a hotbed of criminality, the Texas congressional districts that he was involved with and the people he went to Congress with in his Texas delegation, Tom DeLay and some of these other criminals. The fact that he was with a Zionist-run group called the Mises Institute, the fact that he was running his campaign promoting the idea that gold was the right solution for our future, knowing full well that gold is 99% of our gold is in the hands of the elites, and that they would be in immediate control of the next system that we implemented if we use gold, And so my point is this, is that there were so many reasons that this guy was rotten, and yet the guy raised $20 million. The guy could stand up there and not tell the truth about 9/11, and everybody made excuses for him. Until one day he got on television, Muhammad, and said, I think that people who believe that that 9/11 is a government operation are not people that I want supporting me, he says.
Wow.
Now, this kind of man used the goodwill and the ignorance of the populace, as they always do, to take advantage of everyone. Now, I'm no genius here, but I can tell you one thing. You know, when you look at something that easy to add up, I'm wondering how everybody could have got it so badly wrong.
Well, you were heavily criticized for criticizing him, weren't you, Darryl? I mean, that was a lot of people came out and had a real hard go at you. And now what we have to do is we have to see whether those people are humble enough to, A, admit they got it wrong about the man, and B, where they publicly criticized you for your suspicions, that they actually now turn around and apologize in the way that they should for the way that they spoke about your suspicions. Your suspicions were on the man himself, and they've been proved to be 100% correct. Those people have to now say that they were wrong to speak out against the suspicions, that suspicions were allowed to be voiced, that actually some of the evidence you were putting up, like PNAC, my goodness, how could anybody co-author a book with anybody involved in PNAC? I guess a project for the New American Century. I mean, it's just, for PNAC, read Zionism. You know,
yep.
I mean, it's a completely 100% Zionist-inspired movement. The whole PNAC thing was just total Zionism. And if he's co-authored a book, that would be rather like, you know, me going out and saying, well, you know, I know I've written a book with Ariel Sharon, but fundamentally I'm still against Zionism and the State of Israel. You know, but we were buddies for a little while, yeah. It is a nonsense, and you highlighted the fact that it's a nonsense now.
Well, you know, the other thing I talked about the other day with this gal named Jennifer Dixon, she's been working better part of her adult life here fighting for the Palestinian truth to come out worldwide. I said that short of going to war against Israel, I don't think we're going to stop a genocide against that society. I think they are going to slowly but surely murder and starve to death and poison and kill every single human being in the Gaza and West Bank until every one of them have perished the earth. And short of an all-out war, which I believe we should declare on Israel, we're not going to stop them from killing these people. And the fact is that we're in a situation now where we're being faced with our own conscience here. We all know what they're doing to the Israelis are doing to these Palestinians. They have no water. They've shut off their electric. They don't have medicines. They have no money. They've stopped their food shipments. They've stopped their ability to grow a garden, their own food. They've stopped them from fishing off their own coast, and they can't even leave the places they live in, so they're actually imprisoned there, rotting and dying. And they are subjected every day to sniper attack and murder. Their children are killed and indiscriminately. And my point is this. When is enough for these people? Are we so callous and so hardened as humans that we cannot fight for others who are being so mercilessly slaughtered? It's unbelievable that I watch this happening.
It's a terrible thing, Darryl. They've been getting away with it for a long time. And the whole point is that the internet has now come along. It's there in your face, as the saying goes. A lot of stuff they did for a couple of decades was out of the view of the public. It's now in view of the public. And what's amazing is seeing how the mainstream media just continually ignores this plight.
we're hearing lots of stuff about Darfur at the moment, and we hear about earthquakes here and natural disasters there and landslides there and snow causing, you know, 50 people to die, or hurricanes causing 50 people to die. And it's front page. You know, some hurricanes, some tornadoes coming to the United States, there's 60, 70 people dead. It's across all the front pages, 70 people dead. 200, 300 people get killed in Gaza raids on a daily basis. It's nowhere.
Yeah.
Absolutely nowhere.
I'm heartbroken to watch what they're doing there. And then I know they've got designs on this Chadian thing. Has a lot to do with the Darfur region. It has to everything to do with destabilizing that area, because there's an ocean of oil sitting underneath those desert sands. We know the Janjaweed was financed by Israel and America, CIA. We know that they did the same thing in the Congo. And we know that the Rwandan genocide with the Hutus and Tutsis was propagated and pushed forward by French forces as well as American, and then allowed to happen, and then these people sat back and watched mass murder and genocide take place. In fact, they were even providing some of these Tutsis and Hutus with weapons to go kill each other with. They gave them the machetes they needed to do it with. This kind of stuff, Mohammed, going on in the world, and people aren't paying any attention to it. They've become... We are becoming the monsters that are ruling us. We have no more... We don't care about our fellow man in any way anymore. We're just becoming these uncouth, self-absorbed, mentally ill, sick, like the people ruling us group. And I can't say that that's everybody, because the listening audience here certainly does not add up to that kind of condemnation, but certainly the world at large is just absolutely vile in their ignorance to these facts, and I can't believe what's going on.
Well, you know, Darrell, one of the things that is important for the preservation of the spiritual self, you know, and the mental self, is that when you see these kinds of things, it's important to hate them in the heart, you know, and where people actually lose the will to hate it in the heart and just become anesthetized to it and conditioned to it, at that point it becomes dangerous, because you can stand by and watch anything after that.
That's right.
Stand by and ignore anything after that. So if you learn to live with one and accept one, you will end up living with and accepting them all. And that's why it's a very important door not to open. You have to say to yourself, no, it's wrong, and I'm going to hate it, and that's the end of it. And I'm not going to hear somebody justify it on, you know, grounds of there are only democratic friends in the Middle East or whatever. It's just totally unacceptable. You know, I really did enjoy seeing the pictures this December of the nativity scene, which had been produced by some Christian group, where, you know, you had, you know, the baby Jesus in his cot, and the three wise men had turned up at the stable and were unable to get access to baby Jesus and his mother because of this barrier which had been built through the middle of the stable. You know, and what it said in the caption was, you know, had the three wise men arrived today, they would have been unable to gain access to Jerusalem because this wall would have stopped them from getting in. And
That's right.
It kind of drives it home. You know, we saw also the Christian Protestant movement, the Presbyterian Church, last week in America, saying that they were going to pick up the calls for divestment from Israel again. But we have to ask, Darrell, you know, well, hold on a minute. You went out there, you know, blowing the horns and beating the drum of divesting from Israel, and then you pulled out. Why? What on earth caused them to abandon something which they recognized needed doing? Their money is supporting the Israeli, they've got money invested in firms which are profiting from the oppression of the Palestinians and the murder of children. The fact of the matter is that they should have pulled out of that morally a long time ago. I mean, it's heartening to see them reconsidering it, but we have to ask the question, why did it need reconsidering?
Well, and where are the other denominations, and where are the other? See, of course, you know as well as I do that the leadership, such as the Falwells, you know, thank goodness he's part of the earth, but the Robertsons of the world, and the you know, all of these other, the Hagees of the world, these criminals, they are criminals. They are treasonous and murderous and assassinous. Oh God, there isn't a word for these people, but they're most disgusting humans ever. Because they're in the name of righteousness and goodness, they are promoting a murderous regime in the Middle East and saying clearly that their flock, their group of people who follow them, should ignore the teachings of the religion they claim to follow and support a vicious Zionist regime that everyone who looks at it knows is the most heinous group of criminals possibly the world has ever known. And right. I think that would probably be an understatement based upon the murders and the criminality that has visited itself upon us in the last two centuries, Mohammed.
I don't understand how people in America who, looking at the teachings of Jesus, these Christian people in America looking at the teachings of Jesus, how they can even follow people like that. I mean, when we look at one of the most important teachings in the New Testament, where there's a departure between Jesus and the rabbis and the Jews of his day, was over the issue of the Good Samaritan. And he turned around to those people and said, look, there was somebody sick at the side of the road. You call yourself righteous, and you walk past the man who needed help. And here's a Samaritan that you despise and treat as if he was some lowly dog, and he's the one who's behaved righteously helping the sick man at the side of the road. So what kind of righteousness do you claim to put out? What kind of righteousness do Christians of this Zionist belief put out when they are supporting people who not only are not helping people who are down, they're oppressing them? I mean, it's rather like, you know, these are people who aren't actually walking past the injured man at the side of the road. These guys are going over and giving him a kick in the teeth while he's down, and somebody's giving him money for doing it. It's just so far from the teachings. I find it incredible.
Well, what I've done here in my own home, and this has happened some time ago, is I don't watch mainstream television. I don't subject myself to the brainwashing bombardment of the nonsense, although I can check on it from time to time when I want to, but we are actually at the point now where the filth and disgust that comes on these airwaves in France has dropped to such a low level where they have how to make a porno film as one of the programs, and how to have sexual vegetables, and you use your imagination with some of this. These are programs on the Food Channel and on History Channel is about, at night, this history of the sex in India. And these all are coming on at times when children could watch. And I'm sitting here saying to myself, if you change it to any other channel, you get Autopsy is the program's name, or Dead Like Me, or 24, which is the, terrorism, how do we torture everybody around us. It's amazing the sickness that is being spewed out over this tube, and I'm wondering how long is it going to be before we sever that? We have to sever that box, because that box, I believe, is the main root to this illness. And once that is severed, I think that the health will start returning to the body. And I'm wondering if we can't promote right, you know, today, tomorrow, in the next file, whenever it is I get on air, that people turn away from television completely. As a sickness, it's like an AIDS virus coming out of that screen. What do you think, Mohammed?
Well, I actually abandoned TV a long, long time ago. I think about 18 years ago. I remember reading something by the then chief rabbi of New York, who said that television was an open sewer into the brain. You know, that you're not filtering what you're looking at and considering. And it's amazing, you know, when you look at, like, the 9/11 thing, and everybody says, oh, well, I just watch TV for the documentaries and the news and to keep myself informed. I say, well, hold on a minute. Now the internet turned up. There's the facts on 9/11. The tube that you rely on to keep you informed and up to date with news is actually lying to you. So if you are making the claim, I only watch it for documentaries and facts and to be up to date with the news, you must now recognize, surely they must now recognize, Darryl, that that's not what's even happening with that small percentage they claim to be watching. It can't be relied upon as a medium for truth and a place for information. Rather, it's a place of disinformation, a place where people are being willfully misled, and propaganda has become the norm. It's most likely and most probably what you're looking at today is propaganda. It used to be that a bit of propaganda got slipped in here and there. Now,
that's right. And now it's a bit of truth once in a while slips out by accident.
Yeah, that's it. Absolutely. Mm. Completely pointless watching that stuff. So, you know, for somebody who wishes to respect their own brain and their own intellect and their own intelligence, if you have respect for your own intelligence and your own brain, that alone says that you can't accept the nonsense which is being pushed out over the mass media.
Well, you know, and here it is. One of the benefits, the side benefits of me not watching TV for a very long time, in fact, for 12 years when I lived in Hawaii, I didn't even own a TV. And then after that, I got a black and white TV for about 6 years, and this is not that long ago. And I mean, the fact is, Muhammad, it frees you up because you're not there being bombarded by ignorance. You're not being hypnotized into this stupidity. You're a much more active human being. You're much more alive. You're much more able to go out and discern for yourself the facts as they are in the world and actually get a lot more done in your life. It's a satisfaction I would not trade for anything. But that being said, we've been going on for about an hour and 20 minutes here, and I want to let you know. And as usual, we kind of touched on a lot of subjects, but the principal one today, of course, was the ever increasing financial nightmare. Muhammad, I rely on your conversations with me and the listeners to bring information out that otherwise would be muddled. I think, you know, the way we just discuss these things, and even if we're not getting it perfectly right, and no one ever does. At least we're bringing forward the arguments that people need to start considering. You know, this is not perfect information, and none of us are availed to any perfect information, but we get enough of it right on a daily basis that this is the place that you're going to get the best facts. So I want to thank you for doing that with me again, and I invite you back anytime you'd like to come back, hopefully soon. And I appreciate it, my friend.
It's a pleasure, Darryl.
Well, you know, I think there's going to be a deepening of this, ladies and gentlemen. We're certainly looking at tougher times ahead. Care for your families. Turn off the TV set and look into the face of your children or your wife or your other family members, or go and visit a relative, or do something for somebody you don't even know. Help other people become educated. Tell them about the French Connection. Share with them Ben Friedman's audio file. Give them one of the books that's on the website, the Leafs book, or the Mal Ramsey book, or the just so many of them, Henry Ford, if you will. But keep pushing, because we are winning in inches here, ladies and gentlemen. We're not going to win this thing overnight. It's going to take time. It's going to take effort. But until the next time, this is Darryl Bradford Smith telling you all, please be well. Bye-bye now.